Morning. Instead of reading it all up front, as a little bit of a lengthier passage, we're going to kind of talk and read our way through it. First of all, you know, it's not we don't normally recognize birthdays here, but when God grants somebody 90 years of life and also uses those 90 years to be a wonderful blessing to the church family, it's great to pause and to give thanks for that. So I'm seeing Marge Gizzy over here, and just very thankful for the life that. All right, so before we dive into our text this morning, I want to talk about our name for a second. Grace Church, Grace Bible Fellowship Church. We haven't talked about our name in a little while. But I was thinking about our name this week, and, you know, when you think about the term grace in our language, in our culture, it's a very common name. It's a name that perhaps has become somewhat generalized, maybe even softened in that as it's become generalized, grace. You know, we hear the term grace a fair amount. So much so that I wonder if we maybe forget, just a little bit, that the actual concept of grace is actually quite strange in our culture. Maybe even borderline offensive. I mean, think about it this way. If you saw a successful business owner, maybe a guy who has the best barbecue shop in all the Philadelphia region, and you go up to the guy and you say, "Hey, man, you've got the greatest barbecue shop in town, the best barbecue I've ever had. Like, how'd you do this?" And he says to you, "Well, what can I say? I'm just a very gifted person, and I've learned how to use my gifts." Or if he said to you instead, "Well, I tell you, it's been a lot of hard work. Man, a lot of grit, a lot of frustration, a lot of trial and error, a lot of failing, getting back up." Right? Which response is more common, sounds more natural, or sounds less strange? Or if you came to me, right, and you do like Karen, where is Karen? I was going to say like Karen Cowan does every week and says, "Oh, Pastor, what a wonderful sermon, you know, it's such a life change." She's not even here. But if you came to me and you said, "What a great sermon, what a life-changing sermon, I can't wait to go home and put into practice all the great nuggets of wisdom from that sermon." And I say to you, "Hey, well, you know, what can I say? I just, I've been given so many good gifts in life." And or if I said to you, "Well, yeah, what can I say? God has given me gifts." Versus if I said to you, "Yeah, thanks, I appreciate that. I worked really hard on that sermon this week. I was up really early in the morning studying and went through a lot of walks in the woods just to kind of iron it out and, you know, and get it all ready." Like, which one sounds more natural or more common versus which one sounds almost a little bit offensive? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I forgot to dismiss the kids. Thanks, Hannah. There they go. I thought everybody was getting offended right away and off they go. Nope. Right, to talk of gifts, you know, in a culture where we prize hard work and ethic, or hard work and, you know, diligence, in a culture where we're all supposed to be created equal, right? To talk about a special giftedness almost seems arrogant or prideful. But the interesting thing, or the ironic thing, is that you go into the New Testament, and Apostle Paul will talk about the church as being a very gifted body, endowed with many powerful, mighty gifts. And he'll call those gifts in the Greek charismata, which means gifts of grace. Meaning it's not gifts that you worked hard for and you developed and you ironed out. They're all gifts of free grace to you. That's why Paul will say in 1 Corinthians, is not all that you have and all that you are grace and a gift given that you have received? And so if you have received it, why do you boast as if you hadn't received it? It's almost like for the Apostle Paul to talk about what we accomplish and who we are as the result of our good work and our hard work and our labors and our efforts. For Paul, that almost is to be arrogant. For Paul, to be the church is to be a grace church. All that we are, all that we have is God's grace. It's undeserved. Which gets maybe to a little bit of the offensive part. Imagine if we changed the name out there to Undeserved Bible Fellowship Church. Or undeserving. Right? At best, somebody would say, "Oh, isn't that cute? They're trying to be humble," or whatever. Otherwise, it just looks odd and maybe borderline offensive. What do you mean that I'm undeserving of what I have? I've worked hard for this. So there's a strangeness to that. The other thing about our name, Grace Church, is to say that if we're going to say, or look at it this way, if all that we have and all that we are is a product of our hard work and our ingenuity and our go-stick-to-itiveness, well, just like on an individual level, that affects in one way the way we hold on to the things that we have accomplished and earned for ourselves. Rather, if we're going to say that our name is in our life, and all that we have is grace that we have simply received, well, then that should affect in some ways, that should have a similar or different effect on the way we hold on to the things that we have been entrusted with, the things we've been given. Which is all to say, I think, Grace Church is something of a strange name in our culture. It should be strange. Or if you look into the New Testament church, the concept of the church, it's a little bit strange, this community of people rooted in grace. Or if you look at the kingdom of Christ, in distinction with all the rest of the kingdoms of the world, a kingdom rooted and built upon the receipt of grace, there's something strange about that. And we get a little bit of a foreshadowing of that in our passage today, a little bit of this strange kingdom that is coming to fruition in the life of Israel. It's a foreshadowing of the kingdom of Christ, and it's that strangeness that I want to kind of mine out of the passage this morning, okay? So that's sort of where we're going. We're coming to the end of our book, the end of 1 Samuel, and as we're tying this book together, we're also coming to a close David's period in the wilderness. We've been tracking with David now for quite a few chapters, quite a few weeks, as he's been working his way through the difficult life in the wilderness. Because he is on the run from King Saul. Saul is the king, and he's very jealous of David. He is very bitter and angry that David is the heir to the kingdom, and so Saul wants him dead. And so David is on the run throughout the wilderness. And of course, the wilderness has been some other things as well, too. Right, the wilderness has been a place where David has learned, I think, in new ways of the providence of God, learned in new ways about the mightiness of God's hand in whose life, or who holds David's life. In the wilderness, David has learned, really, I think, what it means to yield to and to submit to the authority of God and the purposes of God for his own kingdom. Even when things get difficult, or when David has opportunity to take matters into his own hands. In other words, David has learned through the wilderness what it means to be a king the way God would have him be king and steward over his kingdom. So we're bringing that period to a close. This is the last episode in the wilderness narrative, and it comes with, I think, two tests. Perhaps his hardest test, his hardest challenges yet. He's on his way back to Ziklag, his town where he's kind of set up shop with his families and his men. And he's coming back from the town of Aphek. Remember where we last left David in chapter 29 there in the beginning? To hide from Saul, David was camped out actually with the enemies, with the Philistines, and he was playing as if he was one of them. He was playing nice with the king Achish, pretending to be on his side. And Achish says, all right, David, well, come on, we're going to go wage war against your people, the Israelites. David says, okay, let's go. But thankfully, at the last minute, the rest of the Philistines say, no, we don't trust this guy in the least. We don't want anything to do with him in battle with us. Send him back home. And so that's where we pick up today. Now, David is making and his 600 men are making the 25 to 30 mile trek from Aphek to Ziklag, 3 days' journey. And here's the scene as they are coming upon their hometown. Perhaps a little bit of a distance, they start to see smoke rising. And maybe as they get a little bit closer, they start to smell the smell of charred wood, scorched earth. Because in verse 1 of chapter 30, we're in chapter 30 of 1 Samuel, if I didn't mention that already. When David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. And they had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, probably because they were intending to sell them off as slaves, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. And so then verse 4 says, David and the people who were with him raised their voices and they wept until they had no more strength to weep. 3 days march, 50 to 60 miles, tired, exhausted, come upon your city, burned to the ground. No voices of children running around playing in the field, no voices of women, you know, out and about doing their thing, looking after kids, no voices of the cattle or the sheep or whatever out in the fields. All of it's been taken. And as they come, they're overwhelmed. Physically exhausted, emotionally exhausted. They weep, literally, the text says, until they have no more strength to push any more tears out or to weep anymore. It's like Pastor Tim after he preaches a sermon. Like, you just weep until you got nothing left. And then what starts to happen, you start to get in the midst of the physical and emotional exhaustion. Some people start to think, you know, and the thing is, if David just had left some of us behind, maybe just 100 of us, just behind, just keep watch over the city, I bet you none of this would have happened. After all, this is probably the work of the Amalekites, and we all know the Amalekites are a bunch of cowards. They never face you in battle square on. They only come and they pick you off from the rear, or they wait until you're in a position of vulnerability, and they come. If we had just had 100 people here, I bet we could have defended our city, no problem. And then that little thought turns to perhaps bitterness amidst all the exhaustion, and maybe these guys are starting to say, hey, come on, David, we've been following you for years out here in the wilderness, sleeping in caves, then back and sleeping in the wilderness, then back into caves, and we've watched you time and time again, and we've trusted you. Wow, you've had opportunities to put an end to this, and you didn't do it. And we said, okay, David, we're hitching our wagons to you. All for what? We come to it here at the end, and our cities are burned, and our families and all that we have has been taken away. And amidst all the exhaustion, amidst of all the irrationality perhaps going on the day, some of them get angry, such that we hear in verse 6, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for their sons and daughters. We're actually told in the text, too, in verse 5, that David's two wives have been taken captive as well, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And I think the text is telling us that to let us know that David himself is not spared the agony of this situation. David himself has had to hike the 3 days journey. David himself has emotionally exhausted himself, spending every tear that he has. David himself now grieves for who knows what has happened to his wife and his kids. And now piled on top of that, his men are beginning to turn on him, and in the bitterness and the distress, they're talking of stoning him. So here's the first test. What do you do now? You're in David's position and you're at wit's end. You're at the end of your rope. I mean, literally, you've been spending the past couple years in the wilderness on the run, and here you are, your cities are burned, your people have been taken, you're physically exhausted, you're emotionally exhausted. Now your own people are turning against you. In that moment of utter despair, what do you do? Do you turn and run? Do you throw in the towel and say, I got nothing left. There's nothing more for me to do here. I'm done. I'm finished. Do you be like Saul, who maybe tries to defend himself in front of his people, or maybe tries to appeal to them and to win their hearts back over and says, hey, guys, I know we've suffered lots, but, you know, I've got some land and a bunch of sheep back in, back in Judah. Let's go back there. Or do you be like Saul, who maybe flies off in a fit of rage and takes whoever is left that's loyal to them and demands that they grab their spear and their sword and quickly put an end to anybody who has this malicious thoughts going on in their minds? Well, David has learned something of what you do when you face adversity, what you do when the wilderness rears its ugly head and wreaks its havoc on your life. And what does David do at the end of verse 6? David strengthened himself in the Lord. David strengthens himself in the Lord. I thought about that that line, you know, a bit this week, and just bear with me here for a second. Because my mind, I was taken to Psalm 18. Again, yeah, just bear with me. I want to read a couple of these verses for you because I was thinking about what does it mean to strengthen yourself in the Lord? And in Psalm 18, you actually get David's reflection on all of this end of the wilderness time when God delivers him from Saul, from the Amalekites, even from the malicious intents of his own people. And it's kind of a reflection on that. And listen how David talks about this. He says, "The cords of death encompassed me. The torrents of destruction assailed me. The cords of Sheol entangled me. The snares of death confronted me. And in my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help." And then look at how he talks about what happens. Verse 7, "Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations of also of the mountains trembled and quaked because God was angry. And smoke went up from his nostrils, and devouring fire came from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down with thick darkness all around his feet. He made darkness his covering. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through his clouds." Verse 14, "He sent his arrows and he scattered them. He flashed forth lightning and routed them." Or verse 16, "He sent from me, from on high, and he took me. He drew me out of the many waters, and he rescued me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support." It's okay, look at this. Think about this. You go back into 1 Samuel, or you read Chronicles or 1 Kings, and I have no account of this sort of literally happening where all of a sudden the heavens are rendered and all of a sudden comes this magnificent God with smoke coming out of his nostrils and fires of coal coming out of his, or coals of fire coming out of his mouth, and he's hurling lightning bolts and he's shaking the foundations of the mountains. This is poetic license. Right? This is David describing in the grandest terms the way God delivers him. But look, do you see? I think this is how what it means for David to be strengthened in the Lord. I imagine David, he maybe steeled away for a little bit, or he just directed his thoughts to the Lord. He cried out in his distress. He cried out in his time of need. And then he envisions God. He meditates on God. In his mind's eye, he sees God not just as, you know, nice little pal who's with him and says, "Oh, David, there, it's okay, I'm with you, you know, let's talk about this," or whatever. No, he envisions God as this awesome and terrifying ally or defender of him and his cause. In other words, what is he doing? He's overwhelming himself with this incredible vision of the glory and the power and the might of who God is. And I imagine that as he does that, all of a sudden, this regular situation and circumstance that was so overwhelming to him, all of a sudden probably looks a little bit smaller in comparison. Do you see that? I think this is what it means for David to strengthen himself in the Lord. And I personally have come to appreciate this. For me, Psalm 18 has been a psalm that's come to mind just a few times, or more than a few times over this past year, for whatever reason. And whenever there are circumstances or situations that at times can be just a little bit overwhelming, man, it's been a blessing to just stop and to just soak in, meditate on this vision of this incredible, awesome, fierce ally. And then all of a sudden, the life circumstances and situations don't quite seem so overwhelming. So in light of this vision, in light of being strengthened in the Lord, David comes out and he says, okay, he has a renewed sense. We're going to do here whatever it is God's purpose is. So He grabs Abiathar, verse 7, "Bring me the ephod," he says. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them?" And God answered, "Pursue, for you shall surely overtake, and you shall surely rescue." So David gets his guys. Come on, guys, let's go. For whatever reason, the 600 guys are all in again. They say, all right, David, let's go. We'll do this one more time. And they set out, and they come to the brook of Bezor, another 15 miles perhaps down the road. And here's where the text tells us 200 guys, this is as far as they can go. They've got nothing left. They're just physically exhausted, and they have to stop at the brook. I don't know if these are guys who, you know, the past year or two, as they've been camped out in Ziklag, maybe they let themselves go a little bit, had too many cheesesteaks. Or maybe these are just the older people in the bunch. Or maybe these are the people who have heart conditions in the bunch or whatever. For whatever reason, they're just too exhausted. They don't have, they're too weak. They can't go any further. And so 200 stay behind. David says, fine, stay there. I'll take the other 400. Off we go. It could take 400. It could take 100. It could take 6.5. It doesn't matter. God has already told them what the outcome's going to be. David says, let's go get it. And so David pursued with his 400 men. This is verse 10. 200 stayed behind. They were too exhausted to cross the brook. In verse 11, they found an Egyptian in the open country, and they brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins, and what he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. For you, here's the little tidbit for you Bible geeks out there. chapter 30 actually interestingly parallels chapter 28, 29. Our last week's passage that the Raj delivered for us. Right, there's an interesting parallel going on here. Both of these guys, David and Saul, start off the chapter facing stiff opposition. Saul from the Philistines, David from the Amalekites, and from his own men. Both of them set out to try to strengthen themselves somehow. David strengthens himself in the Lord. Saul has to strengthen himself, or at least try to, with the witch of Endor, because he's killed all the priests of God, and he's turned every which way except towards God otherwise. And in both scenes and scenarios, a meal is given. Saul, in his weakness, receives a meal from the grace and the sacrificial giving of the woman there at Endor. David, out of his strength, gives a meal to the Egyptian, gives him water, gives him fruit, gives him cakes and whatnot, and he's revived. And it returns dividends for David. David asks him who he is. He says, I'm an Egyptian. I had an Amalekite master, but my master just basically left me for dead here. Fell sick 3 days ago. And David says, well, will you take me to this band of raiders of yours? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band. And so verse 16, then sure enough, they set out and they come upon the Amalekites, living high, you know, off of their spoils, drunk, dancing, whatever, and sure enough, David makes quick work of them. David accomplishes exactly what David said, what God said would happen. You shall pursue, you'll find them, you'll overtake them, you'll rescue them. And then the text does this interesting thing. Look in verse 17. Notice how many times David is mentioned here. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil, or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him, and the people said, this is David's spoil. You catch the word there, it's repeated. Right? David did this. David did that. David accomplished this. And so everybody's looking at David saying, man, David, this is your spoil. And here's the second test. And to be honest, I don't necessarily know which test is harder. The physical, mental, emotional exhaustion facing the, you know, anger of your own people. And what do you do at that point? Or this test here. See, because I imagine some of us maybe, you know, in the face of adversity, that's where the adrenaline kicks in, and that's where we come alive, and we do our best work maybe under pressure, and we're not put off by hard situations, or we're not put off by despair. We just go at it, and that's where we thrive. We live for maybe, not, I say we, not me, but maybe some of you out there, you thrive on that. You live for that, and you do well under pressure. And I wonder if maybe then the test for you, though, then comes when, okay, you succeed and you accomplish and you thrive in the face of adversity and you're enjoying the spoils of your labor and people are coming to say, man, it's so great how you work and that you accomplish and yeah, you deserve everything that you've earned. And maybe at that point, just a little bit, you start to say, yeah, you know, maybe there's something to what they're saying and maybe there is, you know, I don't know. Maybe there is something really good and maybe, yeah, I do deserve the spoils of my hard work and my labor. And yeah, maybe I am entitled to all that I have earned and accomplished for myself. This is actually the opinion of some of David's men. Because they start to head back now, their wives and their family, and all the spoil that they've conquered, they've taken from the Amalekites. And as they head back, sure enough, they come to the brook of Bezor, and there's those 200 weak, tired, exhausted fellas. And some of David's soldiers say, but hey, look, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered. Except that each man may lead away his wife and children to depart. But listen what David says. You shall not do so, my brothers. And here's the key part. With what the Lord has given to us. With what is grace to us. He has preserved us, and he has given into our hand the band that came against us. And look, don't miss the significance of this, right? Don't forget, this is exactly what tripped up Saul. You remember in the beginning of Saul's kingdom, Saul was all about this. Remember the time when Saul defeated Nahash of the Ammonites, and some of his own guys said, hey, we should deal really harshly with those people who doubted you and didn't come and fight with you. And Saul says, no. I didn't do this. God did this. God delivered us from it. And so nobody dies today. But then for whatever reason, just over time, Saul starts to become a little bit more enamored with the things that he accomplishes. He becomes a little bit more in love with this kingdom that he's built. And his grip starts to tighten over all that he's built, all that he's worked for, all that he's earned, such that now if there's ever any ounce of threat to this kingdom that he's built, well, now there will be blood, and now there's going to be heads that are going to roll, and now there will be no mercy shown. How dare anybody come and pose a threat to what I am entitled to what I have worked so hard and so faithfully to build? David has learned this is God's kingdom. He's the steward of it. He's the one who gives it all by grace. And so who is it? Who are we to withhold it? And so in fact, David does this strange thing. He sets up this new principle in the kingdom. Verse 24, for as his share is who goes down into battle, so shall his share be who stays with the baggage. They shall share alike. And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. Actually goes even a little bit further. I won't read the rest of the passage so I don't butcher the names of the cities that are listed in there. But it's, you know, he sends not only spoil to the guys there at Bezor, the brook of Bezor, but he also sends it to all the towns and the leaders of Judah. Perhaps a politically advantageous move, I don't know. But it's more, this is the dynamic of his new kingdom. This is a new kingdom that is all rooted in what God has given, that we are just stewards of. And so we give freely, strangely. And that's our story. It's the end of the chapter. One more chapter to go. But actually, there's one other really, just really neat thing I just want to highlight, point out from the passage. Go back to this brook of Bezor. You've got these 200 weak, tired folks sitting around. You know what the term Bezor actually means in Hebrew? It actually literally means glad tidings. Either glad tidings or flesh, because it would be often be a term that would be announced at the birth of a child, the birth of new life, when everybody's happy and joyous in celebration, right? Bezor is this declaration of glad tidings or good news, right? And if you think about this brook, you know, in this scene, that's exactly what it is. This is a place of glad tidings, because here you have 200 guys who, you know, receive their families, their wives, and their kids back, and hear the great news that they are recipients of the spoils of the king, for which they did nothing, for which they didn't work, for which they didn't labor, for which they didn't strive or fight. They were too weak. They were too exhausted. They were too ineffective for it. But because the king is good and gracious, he liberally shares the spoils of his victory. And so, come on, can you get an easier connection to the gospel than that right there? I mean, the brook is literally named the place of good news, the place of the gospel. And our whole life in Christ, right? To be in Christ, to be a church, a people named Grace, is to be a people who every week come back here and celebrate that fact. Come back to the Brook of Bezor and celebrate this incredible news that we are recipients of the spoils of the King. Not King David, mind you, but King Jesus, who has secured for us eternal forgiveness from the sins that waged against us, who has secured for us victory over the spiritual forces of darkness that rage against God and his people, who has secured for his people resurrection life to the full from the grave, who has secured for his people all the rights and privileges of being sons and daughters of God's eternal family. While you did nothing for it. You didn't work, you didn't strive, you didn't fight for it. In fact, the battle that you were facing, you were dead to rights in it, right? You were far too weak, far too exhausted, far too inability to square up with the problem, the overwhelming problem that you faced. But because your king is powerful, he conquered. And because your king is good and gracious, you are recipients of his spoil. Amen? And remember, too, it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's the spoil that keeps on giving. We don't come to the Brook of Bezor right initially in our initial conversion and moment of salvation and union with Christ. But it's like we never leave the Brook of Bezor. We are always being strengthened and grown by the victory of the King. Or in other words, this grace that is given, these spoils that save us, is also the grace and the power that seals us and transforms us and sanctifies us and keeps us all the way till the project is completed. It's not as if we come to the Brook of Bezor and we find our, you know, initial gifts of salvation and we load them up and then we take off to fight the rest of our battles on our own. No, it says, Paul says in his letter to Titus, the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for us, but it's also this grace that teaches us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and trains us to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age while we're waiting on the appearing of our hope. In other words, it's this never-ending fountain of grace that saves us, that keeps us, that seals us, that enables us to persevere, that sanctifies us all the way to the very end when the project is completed. So that's great news. And it's particularly great news if you're here this morning and you've been considering Jesus, you've been considering Christianity, but you just don't think you are made of that stuff or whatever. You don't think you'll ever be one of those nice, goody, churchy type folk. whatever that is. Or maybe it's good news for you if you've been flirting with Jesus and you've been maybe drawing near to Jesus a little bit, but then you just get kind of sucked back into, you know, whatever else. And then you come back and you draw near to Jesus a little bit and you get sucked back away. And each time you get sucked back away, it's crushing and it's defeating and it brings guilt and it brings shame. And you think, I can't do it. This isn't for me. I'll never be that. Yeah, the great news is you won't. And you aren't. You aren't made of the stuff that could ever secure for yourself the things that Jesus intends for you to have. And so the great message for you this morning is to stop looking at your own effort, your own hard work and ingenuity. Stop prizing those things and look to all that's been accomplished by your King. And look to all that has been freely given to you and receive that. And as you receive that in faith and trusting your life to who Jesus is, what he's done, what he's given, you start to find freedom. You start to find joy and confidence, not in yourself, but in this Jesus who gives and who accomplishes on your behalf. But lastly, and we'll close it with this. This is what it means to be grace people, is that we are recipients of the spoils of the King, for which we did not work, earn, strive, toil, labor, none of that. We're given it by his graciousness. That's what it means to be people of grace. But look, what it also, going back to the beginning, what it also means to be people of grace then is when we realize that this is what has been given to us freely by God's grace, that we didn't earn, toil, strive for it. Do you see how that should change the way we hold on to these things? That all that we have, all the giftedness that we've received, all of that we should hold very lightly because it's not ours by right, it's ours by grace. You know, I think of the Apostle Paul here in, I was going to go to Ephesians 2, but we're running out of time. But, you know, this Paul who talks about the church as being such a gifted body of people, empowered by so much great spiritual gifts. Yet when you listen to Paul talk about it, he says, look, part of the deal is we've been given that grace and we've been gifted with spiritual gifts and life and passions and resources precisely so that we may also participate in the graciousness of the King. And we might give that back in ministry to one another. Right? So to be a people of grace means we are both recipients of God's undeserved grace for us, but we are then participants who freely give that. And for Paul, this is the whole concept of the church. It's a group of people growing up into Christ as we are giving those gifts and as we are submitting ourselves to those gifts and receiving those gifts of the King with one another, in communion with one another. Again, look, we live in a culture that prizes and holds as the greatest virtues and values hard work, determination, grit, right? Again, in a culture where the concept is we're all created equal, it's not about giftedness that anybody would be given a different gift. No, we all just start from the same equal level, and it's got to be hard work and strength and ingenuity that we rise up. And I get all that, and that if we had more time, we could dissect that. But there's some dangers in that. The biggest danger would be that we would ever think, hey, I don't need a king to fight my battles for me. I'm strong enough. I can go do it myself. A more subtle and perhaps even more dangerous danger, is that in the church, we can maybe develop this mindset, okay, but I got Jesus now. So me and Jesus, we're good enough. We're good to go. And I got Jesus with me, and I can ride this out, and I can accomplish all that God wants me to accomplish, be all he wants me to be, do whatever. And biblically speaking, that's just not true. Biblically speaking, it's no, but you need the community of grace. Because this is how the King does his graciousness. He gives each one of us gifts that then he calls back into action. And that together we are participating in his graciousness. And it's this wonderful community of self-giving, self-donation, giving these gifts to one another. And that's what we grow up in. And the danger of overvaluing hard work and determination is new as you think. I don't need that. I can, me and Jesus, we can do this on our own. The other potential danger is that we hold tight to what we have, what we've been given. We think it's ours by right. We don't think that we are mandated or that we have to share or give. And if that would ever be us, then we look like David's foolish sons of Belial, as the text calls them. Right? We don't look anything like Jesus, who, though he was in the very nature of God, didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped, but gave himself up, taking the form of a servant, being obedient even unto death for our sake. All to say, it's a great name. It's a beautiful name. I'm glad we have it. It's a name that reminds us that who are we? What is our life? It's that we are recipients of grace and we are participants in the graciousness of the King. We are a people who are forever bound to, who are ever dependent upon the grace that is given to us from the spoils of the King and the grace that comes to us in the community of grace. We are ever dependent upon that, and it's ever our desire to be more like that King, to give of ourselves, to share of ourselves, to spend ourselves for the sake of the community of grace. So may God do that in us. In the name of the Father, and the Son and the Holy Spirit. We ask it. Amen.